The phone was supposed to be off. That is what made it matter. When investigators with the FBI and the Moscow Police Department began reconstructing the digital footprint of Brian Christopher Koberger in the weeks after four University of Idaho students were found stabbed to death in their off-campus house on King Road, they pulled cell tower records from the months preceding the murders. What they found was a pattern that the prosecution's probable cause affidavit described as a series of visits. 12 documented occasions between August and November of 2022, in which a cell phone connected to Koberger's account pinged towers in the vicinity of the King Road house before the night of the killings. The phone was not making calls. It was not sending messages. It was simply existing in the vicinity of that address, on a schedule that nobody at the time had any reason to consider remarkable. When you are a criminology PhD student at nearby Washington State University, driving through the neighborhoods of Moscow, Idaho on any given night, nothing about your location is by itself suspicious until you are the suspect, and then every ping becomes a question. The murders occurred on the morning of November 13th, 2022, in the hours between 3 and 4 o'clock. Kaylee Goncalves, 21, Madison Mogan, 21, Zanna Kernodle, 20, Ethan Chapin, 20. Four students in a six-bedroom house on King Road. Two survived. Two roommates, Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funka, were in the house during the killings and were found unharmed the following afternoon when a friend, unable to reach anyone inside, called 911. The gap between when the friend called and when investigators established the time of death represents hours of unknowing. Hours in which two people were alive in a house with four people who were not. What Bethany Funky heard, saw, and chose to do or not do during those hours has been the subject of speculation since the first week of the investigation. Her formal account exists somewhere in the sealed discovery materials. It has not been made public, and it is the thread in this case that has never been fully pulled. The identification of Koberger as the suspect came from the intersection of three independent evidence streams. The first was the white Hyundai Elantra. Multiple witnesses near the King Road house in the early morning hours of November 13th reported seeing a white Hyundai Elantra in the area. Surveillance cameras at nearby businesses captured partial images of a vehicle matching that description. The FBI issued a public alert. Koberger owned a white Hyundai Elantra, registered in Pennsylvania, where he had lived before moving to Washington State in the fall of 2022, to begin his doctoral program. When investigators ran the description through vehicle registration databases cross-referenced against the Washington State University population, Koberger's name appeared. His car was photographed by his apartment building's security camera at times that put him in Moscow, Idaho, on the night of the murders and returning in the early morning hours. The second evidence stream was the sheath. A tan leather Khabar knife sheath was found beneath the body of Madison Mogan. Forensic analysis identified a single-touch DNA sample on the sheath, DNA that did not belong to any of the victims or to either surviving roommate. The sample was entered into CODIS, the National DNA Database. It did not match any existing profile, but it established a biological signature that could be compared against a known source. When investigators obtained a DNA sample from trash discarded by Koberger's family during the holidays, using legal collection from garbage placed at the curb, forensic analysis determined that the trash DNA was consistent with the DNA on the sheath at a statistical probability that the prosecution has characterized in sealed filings as 1 in 5.87 quadrillion. One person in 5.87 quadrillion would share that profile by coincidence. The third stream was the cell phone data, Koberger's phone, consistent with multiple of the 12 prior pings in the vicinity of King Road, was placed by cell tower records at a location consistent with travel to Moscow, Idaho, on the night of November 12th into the morning of November 13th. The phone also went dark, ceased pinging any tower, during a period that overlapped with the estimated time of the murders. A phone that has been consistently present in the record, suddenly producing no data, is in digital forensics sometimes more informative than a phone that is present. Phones go dark when they are powered off. or when they are in airplane mode, or when they are in a location with no coverage. Moscow, Idaho is not a coverage dead zone. The prosecution has characterized the gap as deliberate. The defense has challenged all three streams. On the sheath DNA, they have raised the question of touch DNA reliability, the argument that a single touch DNA sample, insufficient for a full profile, carries margins of error that the statistical probability figures obscure. On the cell tower data, they have noted that cell tower pings place a phone within a radius, not at a specific address, and that 12 prior pings in the vicinity of a college town neighborhood does not constitute surveillance of a specific residence. On the Elantra, they have pointed out that Washington State University alone had hundreds of registered white Hyundai Elantras in its campus population in 2022, making the vehicle match significantly less distinctive than the initial media coverage suggested. What the defense has not challenged, because they cannot, because it has not been publicly disclosed, is Bethany Funca's account of November 13th. Here is what the sealed discovery record is understood to contain. Based on the reporting of attorneys and journalists who have reviewed partial filings, Funky told investigators that she heard sounds in the house in the early morning hours of November 13th. She described opening her bedroom door and seeing a figure in the hallway. The figure, described in the probable cause affidavit as a male, not very tall, but stocky build, wearing all black clothing and a mask that covered the lower portion of his face, walked past her door toward the front of the house. She returned to her room. She locked her door. And then, according to the probable cause affidavit, she did not call 911. The affidavit does not characterize this choice as suspicious. It offers no explanation for why she made it. The behavioral science literature on bystander response to traumatic events offers frameworks for understanding, freezing, dissociation, and delayed processing. But those frameworks exist for academic understanding, not for a jury. What a jury will hear, and when they will hear it, and in what form Funca's testimony will be presented, is one of the most consequential, unresolved questions in the trial's pretrial proceedings. The prosecution will almost certainly call her as a witness. The defense will almost certainly attempt to challenge the reliability of her perceptions in a dark hallway at an hour when her stated behavior included choosing not to call for help when four people two floors above her were being killed. Whether that challenge reflects on her or on the accused depends on what the jury decides to do with the space between what she saw and what she chose. The trial of Brian Koberger is scheduled to begin in the spring of 2026. He has pleaded not guilty. The prosecution has indicated it intends to seek the death penalty. The defense has argued that the evidence against their client is circumstantial, contested, and insufficient to overcome the presumption of innocence that every defendant in an American courtroom is constitutionally entitled to. None of that is legally unusual. What is unusual? What has distinguished this case from the beginning is the nature of the evidence itself. This is not a case built on eyewitness testimony. There is no witness who saw Brian Koberger enter the King Road house, commit the murders, and leave. What exists is a constructed digital and forensic record assembled from the trace elements that a human being leaves in a modern world. The signal a phone broadcasts when its owner does not realize it is broadcasting. The DNA transferred by a hand that touched a surface, the image caught by a camera in a parking lot at 4 in the morning. The question that the trial will ultimately force a jury to answer is not whether those elements point to Koberger. The prosecution's position is that they do, overwhelmingly. The question is whether a case built from the residue of a presence, rather than from direct observation of an act, can carry the weight of a verdict. Whether the evidence nobody expected to survive the night is enough, and whether, in a house where two people were alive and unhurt while four were dying, the most important account of what happened that night has still not been fully told. Was the most important witness in the Idaho 4 case inside the house the whole time? And if so, what exactly did she hear and decide not to do?